This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
Hi, I'm Ian Smith. When you're talking about the gay scene in the early 80s, it was pretty phenomenal, actually. We had a lot happening in Christchurch at that time. There were a number of organisations which were very active. And, of course, there was a whole political law reform happening in the mid-80s anyway. And, certainly was a good place to be.
When you say full-on, what do you mean?
Well, there was a variety of activities and things that one could go to, as opposed to, for argument's sake, if you came from down south or somewhere, I mean, it was pretty quiet there. And probably the same for the North Island people in those small centres. And it was a place where people, particularly in South Island, gravitated to. And often pass through on their way after a few years or months or whatever onto Auckland and then probably to Sydney, but it was certainly it was certainly a good place to be. It was pretty exciting.
What kind of venues were available?
There was a number of clubs. There was a sauna, two saunas in fact. I'm just trying to think now. There was Lambda was in the sort of early 80s anyway, from what I can remember. That was a sort of gathering coffee place. It was really quite a good centre for a lot of people who didn't like the bar scene, for argument's sake. There were various other organisations, the Lambda Walker, which is actually still going today, and that's where people got together and tramped various places, I mean, particularly around the mountains and what have you. I just can't recall now, but I know there was quite a lot of activity anyway. Yeah, so it was quite a supportive place for people, and I think that's the interesting thing was that there probably was a degree of ghetto mentality in those days, through the 70s and 80s, where people really congregated together, they felt comfortable together, and then that's where people really came out or introduced their own selves to themselves, shall we say. And I think that was very helpful in many ways in terms of what happened later in terms of AIDS. I don't want to talk about today so much, but the fact was that I think we've lost that community here. We have various isolated pockets, but there's not that sense of community anymore. And people spread far and wide. And that makes it a darn sight harder to actually get messages across. Because they're not as venues anymore. Obviously North Island has more, but here we haven't, due to the earthquake, of course, here we haven't got those venues now in the same way.
Was it easy to be openly gay in Christchurch in the early 80s?
Yes and no. People who didn't care, I mean, obviously were open about their sexuality. I suppose for many people, It was difficult to actually be really open. I mean, Christchurch is reasonably conservative, say, compared to Auckland or Wellington. It was a comfortable place to be. And as I say, you had those alternatives from the heterosexual scene to the gay scene, and that was a great asset for a lot of people.
What about the ideas of knowing what was happening in gay or queer communities around the country or even internationally? Was there much news coming in to Christchurch?
I'm just trying to recall. I mean, there obviously, I mean, people travelled and travelled a lot. And I mean, I've been to various other countries and experienced gay scenes in there. And of course, people coming back will talk about their experiences and what have you. And obviously that would motivate others to actually go as well. I think we were reasonably in touch with what was happening. I'm pretty sure that we knew what scenes were where and what was happening, and particularly in terms of law reform and things, or lack of. So I think we were reasonably in touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess that kind of question comes from nowadays it's so easy to think of communication, you know, with the internet, with Google, with mobile phones. But this isn't an age in the early 80s where there was none of that. And just, I guess I was trying to figure out, well, how isolated was it?
Yeah, I think we had access to other gay information and magazines and what have you from overseas, particularly, say, Sydney and San Francisco and places like that. So, I mean, I think we were pretty well in touch with most things that were happening. We did get regular updates through having those magazines as to what was happening in places. And, of course, I mean, there was always the telephone. We still had the telephone, of course, even though we didn't have the internet. And, of course, the written word as well. So, I mean, letters and what have you would be going backwards and forwards. And, again, experiences would be expressed and transmitted to various other people. So I think it wasn't seen as a liability because we, obviously, we didn't know any different. I mean, that was what we had, and that's what we had to make use of.
When was your first knowledge of HIV/AIDS?
It was September 1984.
What happened then?
Well, it was basically through my flatmate, who was actually a GP, and he'd been over in the States to San Francisco for a holiday and then became very aware of men who are sexual men becoming unwell with this mysterious disease. And it seemed to be following a pattern, particularly within gay community, or gay male community, and Haitian people. So, I mean, that's the first awareness that I had personally. Which obviously instigated our concerns about what might happen here.
How did he relate what was happening in San Francisco? What kind of story?
Well, he was obviously, from a medical point of view, he was obviously concerned because, I mean, here was a disease which was manifesting itself in a totally unknown way and there seemed to be no cure. And everybody was at a loss as to know what to do. And people were dying very quickly. I mean, in those days, it was not unusual for a person who might have contracted the virus to be dead within about 4 months or 5 months. So there was no cure, and there was no way of knowing how they were going to tackle it. And it wasn't until a bit later on they found out it was a virus and so forth. And people like Gallo and the chap in France, Montagnier, discovered the virus, of course, shortly after that.
After kind of that initial hearing of this thing, what did you do?
It was in response to what we'd heard from him, and obviously there were other people in New Zealand becoming rapidly aware because of this communication between, particularly between San Francisco and New York and New Zealand. We decided that we should set up some sort of a support network. And that was actually happening in response in San Francisco, particularly with the Shanty program, which was instituted there. And there was a gay men's health crisis in New York. They were two bodies which had started these support programs for people. Because obviously, being an unknown disease, there was a lot of fear surrounding it. You know, even the medical fraternity didn't know what to do with it. And they were concerned about how it was going to be spread. Could it be spread through the air? You know, with all these things we had, more recently perhaps, with bird flu and all these sorts of things. And in fact, we still get it today. Kindergarten and child centre, in Auckland recently just ostracised the kid for being HIV positive. Anyway, I'm going on a tangent here. That was what we perceived was happening, and we thought, well, we'd better be doing something about it, because even though we weren't aware of having, I didn't say we didn't have it, but we weren't aware of having HIV in New Zealand, it was a case of let's be prepared. So it was at that point where five of us, I think it was now, got together and talked about what we could do. And with the Shanty program in mind, we could set up something similar to support people who ultimately became unwell with HIV.
Can you tell me a wee bit about the Shanty program and how that kind of works?
My memory's a bit hazy on this one now, but the Shanty program basically was a support program which provided care for people who are unwell, who had been discriminated against, probably kicked out of accommodation, lost their positions and work and so forth, and just basically ostracized from society. So it was really a program there which picked up the pieces, and volunteers provided that care. And particularly even where people have lost their partners because their partner was concerned about themselves being infected and that sort of thing. So these people were totally isolated in many ways, but they needed some support, obviously. And that's the shanty program, broadly speaking, provided that. So I presume not only was it just a care in terms of support, but it was also to do with providing food and accommodation and all those other things that were necessary, and hostels and that type of thing.
So the five people that you were talking about that met to talk about forming some kind of support, had that group come together before? I mean, was that part of another organisation that you met, or just individuals coming together?
I mean, these people had some, obviously some input into community as a whole. I mean, they weren't just people coming off the street and said, let's do it. They had been involved in gay politics and all those other things as well. And I mean, all of us had some sort of connection with gay male movements and so forth. It was a question of realising that we had the capability of bringing something together. It was just a matter of organising it and making a start.
So how did you make a start?
We had several meetings, and it was decided, and it was funny because I'd actually sold a business several months before, and I was planning on being semi-retired. I did have an art gallery, which was a small place, and it wasn't going terribly well, but anyway, I had time, and it finished up that I became this coordinator of this group, simply because the other ones were very busy and all had positions and so forth. And it was mooted that we should really begin recruiting people, and that sort of began happening the end of 84. So putting the word out, really, and it was more aimed at, obviously, men who have sex with men or gay, identify themselves as gay. It wasn't discrimination about women. It was just the fact that the men were the ones who were probably primary going to be the ones affected, and therefore their motivation would be to be perhaps involved in an organisation like that. And then we were in contact with Auckland, who were forming a similar organisation, and Wellington was, again, similar. That was basically through more of the gay movement, the gay men's movement. And we then decided that we would recruit people, advertise and all that sort of thing to get people interested, pass the word around, and start a formal process to screen people and that sort of thing. And we set a date for March 85, I think it was March 85, as our first intake. And fortunately, one of our members of the small group was in the midst of the administrator in the CPIT, or the Polytechnic as it was then, and made a room available for us for that first gathering. And we had about, I think we screened about 50 people and found about 30 of them were suitable. I mean, not everybody was always suitable, even though they wanted to be a volunteer. The fact was that they might have some other agenda, or they might have some other stuff, or they might not be able to cope with the situation that might arise. It's as simple as that. So we did the screening process, and we came up with around about 30 people. We accessed some of the expertise from Auckland, because they had several leading people there, Bruce Burnett and Kate Leslie, who was actually the senior social worker with the Auckland Hospital Board. And they could bring skills and awareness about what the real situation is. Bruce had been in San Francisco, and he'd come back from there. So he was obviously aware of the shanty program. And of course, Ray Taylor, who was local, or wasn't local here at the time, he was in Auckland, he also had experience in shanty programs. So we drew on their expertise, and we asked them if they'd come down and help us with the first process in terms of education and a training. So it was basically a formal training based on counselling, based on support. There wasn't much given to prevention at that point in time, because our main concern was, well, okay, a lot of people were overseas, possibly come back, they might be unwell, what are we going to do for them? How have we got a team here to provide that support? And we couldn't rely on existing services, because existing services were pretty ignorant about what the issues were, and were pretty fearful about their own possibility of getting a disease. And the medical fraternity didn't want to know, and the government didn't want to know either, because it was another cost on their health programs. And so it really came down to the community to actually provide that service initially.
When you say the medical community didn't want to know, what does that mean?
Well, basically, they didn't know. They didn't understand what it was. Obviously, we weren't fully informed about what it was, and nobody else overseas really knew either at that point. But it was a case of, I suppose, medical people looking at it as another possible disease which might affect people in this country, but it wasn't here yet. Therefore, there was that great priority, and it was the same with the government and the medical health services in general.
At that stage in 1985, were there many known cases of HIV/AIDS in New Zealand?
There was only about one or two. Yeah.
And Bruce being one of them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it wasn't until later on, getting to 86, that more people came forward.
So,
and it wasn't until later that we actually had our first homegrown person.
Bruce Burnett sounds quite extraordinary, to be able to come back to New Zealand and to be openly positive.
Yeah, yeah.
And not only that, be actually actively setting up support groups. Did you know him much?
No, I never met him. He did a trip through the South Island, which basically raised awareness with a few leading people in the community here. But it was quite a quick trip. I mean, it was probably only about a few days, and then back to north again. I think he obviously was aware that it was there was a need for awareness about the disease and what was happening, and that's why he put a face on it. And that still really applies today. It hasn't changed, because if you hide the disease and hide the people, then people think it's gone away. So Bruce really did what was necessary to do, and what we needed to do in the future as well. I mean, I know it's pretty hard to ask a person to do that, or even a person to volunteer to do that, but it's very necessary to do it. And I respect them greatly for doing it, because I know how hard it would be. But, Bruce was the first person who really got out there and said, well, look, I'm HIV positive, or whatever it was in those days, I can't remember. And this is what is going to happen to me, which ultimately did. And he motivated people to really get going and doing something about it.
Can you recall in those early days in 84, 85, what the feeling was within, say, the gay community towards this?
Really ambivalent. I think the fact was denial. I mean, it's overseas, so what? Let's carry on doing it. I mean, we didn't really know how it was actually being transmitted. We knew there was something to do with sexuality and sex and stuff like that. And it was probably to do with, well, why gay men? Why Haitians? I mean, there's all those questions coming up, you know. And you put two and two together to some extent, but you knew that gay men, particularly in those areas like the Castro and San Francisco, I mean, sex was full on multiple sexual partners and so forth. I mean, that was the same thing happening here too, but it seemed to lean itself towards the possibility that it could be just a gay disease, but we still weren't convinced about that. It didn't matter whether it was a gay disease anyway, because the fact is, it was a disease. And I couldn't see anybody's sexuality having an effect on that. The fact was that you're a human being and you picked up a virus, so what? That person needs support and treatment. Simple as that. So, I mean, it was, but here I think, yeah, it took a while before people really realised exactly what the situation possibly could be here.
And what about in the wider community? Was there kind of apprehension, or just something that this was actually happening overseas and we didn't need to care about it? Or
I think people latterly in 85 were becoming more concerned about it. There was more news coming through about the numbers of people and the fact that people were dying relatively quickly, and there was no cure, and it had taken a long time for governments to get into gear and to be doing anything. In fact, it was the gay community who produced the first leaflets and pamphlets that went out. And the health department had refused, or the government refused, to fund any of that sort of stuff at all. So it was the gay community who funded those initial information-type pamphlets. And funnily enough, the health services grabbed them. I mean, they thought it was great. I mean, here's some information about a disease we knew nothing about. And, I mean, the fact was that the AIDS organisation, or the AIDS support network initially, provided really the only information, any substantial information, any true information to the public. Not only the public, but, of course, to their own communities as well. And the health services then began to recognise that here was a real problem. So, I mean, that whole process that people gradually became aware of that and were concerned was part, an important part of the process to actually start prevention work. But unfortunately, there's always people out there who, in denial, they don't want to know. And that hasn't changed much from then till now.
So the organisation based in Christchurch, did it have much to do with the other centres like Wellington and Auckland? Was there a kind of an overarching communication? Or?
Oh, there was communication, yeah. I mean, later on, in course 85, 86, there were regular sort of get-togethers of these organisations, but that really came more under the umbrella of the AIDS Foundation. But initially, we were working a bit in isolation, I suppose. But we were obviously sharing information, and we were trying to model our programs similar to others.
Could you describe for me that first intake of volunteers, so the 50 people, what kind of people were coming forward?
All gay males. Well, men have sex with men, whether they identified as gay or not. As I say, out of that 50, we selected only 30. There were people who had been active in the community, various organisations and what have you, or people who felt that they needed to do something or needed to provide what they could in terms of expertise or their knowledge or whatever it was, or just their person power, really, you know, being able to do something. And it was a pretty broad spectrum of community. I mean, it was from, well, whatever, bricklayers through to professors. You know, I mean, it was a good cross-section of people of all ages, probably more in the sort of late 20s, 35 age group, mainly, yeah.
And when you say screening, what kind of things did you say or do to kind of get down to 30 from 50?
Was more about asking people what they saw as what they can contribute and what sort of skills they brought to that. Whether they had any background in terms of medical or counselling and what have you. And also their motivation was the important one. We didn't really want people who really just wanted to help people, you know, help people from the illness and that sort of stuff, or help a cure or something like that. Maybe some religious affiliations, more the way out ones, I should say, would have been excluded because of again, their motivations in terms of their own agendas. It was the agenda that we were particularly concerned about. Because, let's face it, you're dealing with people who are unwell, who are really facing a short lifespan, and they certainly didn't want to have to cope with somebody else's agenda and lack of understanding. So there was those things. I mean, you can't always be 100% on these things, but I think with the skills that our panels, our panel brought to the interview process, brought out any deficits, shall we say. I know we set ourselves up as judge and jury, but I think that's necessary at that point.
And you say it was March 1985 that was
the first intake.
The first intake. Mm. Around that time was when the Homosexual Law Reform Bill was going through Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
How did that impact on what you were trying to do in terms of supporting people with HIV/AIDS?
Well, we weren't supporting anybody at that point. You must remember, I mean, this was the initial phase. We didn't have anybody apart from Bruce in Auckland. We didn't have anybody down here, anyway, that we knew of. So really, it was really a mix of... I suppose it was helpful in a way that the whole law reform process was taking place, because it gained access to those people who were political and were willing to get off the butts and do something. And also it gave a venue to recruit from. It gave a venue for raising awareness. And it also provided, latterly, the AIDS Foundation with a pretty good hammer in terms of the bill and why it should be passed. So it became political as well. AIDS became political, but it was for the benefit of the community that it became political. And I mean, there are other people who are far more involved in that side of it than me. I was more involved in trying to get an organisation off the ground and getting people trained.
Well, if you could maybe talk to me about the training, what was involved in training people?
We went through the issues about the possible transmission disease. We went through issues about death and dying. Also talking about supports and what sort of supports we would provide. We didn't set ourselves up to be counsellors, but counselling was an integral part in terms of the volunteers of being aware of processes and what happens there. We talked about the health system and we talked about referring on and all those sessions, I mean, over a two-day period. There was a lot of bonding going on as well, a lot of those sorts of bonding activities and what have you. And getting people to talk about themselves and how they felt about it and what would happen and so forth. So it was a real mixture of understanding about disease and dying and so forth, but also understanding themselves and how they would cope and understanding what support systems needed to be in place and so forth, and understanding what they could expect from the health system. So that was 2 days. After that, we had regular trainings on a Monday night for 6 weeks. And that, again, we didn't make any final decisions as to who was going to be in the group until then. We started off with the initial 30-odd, and they carried on for 6 weeks. And after that, if anything came out which wouldn't be helpful for the person with the disease, then we would ask them if they would mind just standing aside at the moment. There'd be something else for them later on. So, I mean, it was primarily focused on support. And to that end, we brought in experts from other fields who were involved in support for other diseases, and they provide their expertise. So those sessions, as I say, went on for 6 weeks. And at the end of that 6 weeks, another assessment done. Some people opted out and said, well, no, it's not for me, it's too heavy. And others stayed in, of course. So the first support group was formed, basically. And then from then on, we had, I think for that year, we had another two groups formed, following the same process.
And of similar size?
Yeah, basically. We could pick and choose a bit because we had a good pool of people now. At the moment, we didn't have anybody to support, mind you, but it was an ongoing training process. It was an ongoing process where people would develop themselves and feel comfortable with their own feelings with other people and so forth. So that was very important, yeah.
The training materials that you were using, where did they come from?
Various sources. I mean, we drew on people with that expertise. They provided those resources. And also talking about their own issues and so on with homosexuality and what have you. I mean, all those things had to be confronted, because if somebody wasn't happy about their own sexuality, then, God, you can't put that on somebody who's trying to get through life, you know, the best way they can. So there was all sorts of input there. Mm.
For you, what were the kind of biggest learnings over that period in terms of taking people through this process?
For me, I think I was learning about those issues as well. I had not got a medical background. I hadn't got a counselling background. I hadn't got any of those things. What I did have was an organisational background and an entrepreneurial background. And that was where my strengths will lie. But, of course, obviously I needed to understand. I needed to understand about medicine. I needed to understand about viruses and disease and stuff like that. And I laid my hands on every piece of paper I could about the diseases of developing in the States, from the CDC in Atlanta. That's the Central Disease Control in Atlanta. And got updates every week, or in fact, every day, in fact. I mean, paper was growing thick as well. So I became really, not just me, but other people became experts on what this disease was doing, how it needs to be treated, and not so much treated because there was no treatment then, but how people had to be supported and so forth, and how possible transmissions were and all the rest of it. And also it encouraged me to probably look at more in the terms of social work and social supports and all those sorts of things and community work, which I've been involved in gay politics to some extent, but I hadn't been so heavily involved in other areas of that nature. So it was a development process for me, and had to become an expert, because who else was there? The medical profession didn't know, health department didn't know, government didn't want to know, and the average person in the street had no idea whatsoever. So a few of us became experts, totally out of our fields, about something which is occurring overseas and here.
When you were getting those piles of information from overseas, can you recall what you thought might happen in New Zealand?
I had no doubt that because of the Kiwi liking of travel, I mean, it was usual for people to go overseas, particularly after they've completed their degree or before it or whatever, and those sorts of things. And particularly gay men travel a lot in terms of other communities and what have you. It's only a matter of time. They're bound to have come here. Yeah, we were very aware of that. It was just a matter of time.
Did you have any idea of the possible number of people that might be affected?
We can only gauge that by the by what was happening overseas, I mean, particularly in America. The hundreds and thousands, thousands of people were becoming unwell. It could be anywhere in the States. I mean, it didn't have to be in a major city. So it was obvious that men who had sex with men were very vulnerable. And for some reason, I said before, Haitians. I still don't know this day why Haitians, but anyway. Probably just because the way the virus happened to spread, that was all. So it was only a question of time. It was a question also of making sure people understood in the community. That was an essential thing. But the first part was providing support for people who potentially came back from overseas to New Zealand. They didn't necessarily catch the virus here. They brought it with them. And that also had a double role in terms of protecting the other society as a whole, particularly men who are sick with men, because if they brought the virus back here, they really need to understand that they couldn't do what they wanted to do as they had done before. Not that they were able to anyway, because they were pretty sick, some of them.
So by the end of 1985, were you actually supporting any people with the virus?
No, not south, not here.
And when did that start happening?
Might have been end of 85, 86, but definitely 86, early 86.
And what kind of numbers?
Not large numbers. Only one or two people. They came back from America. Yeah. And we provide support for them.
And what was that like, suddenly being in a real situation as opposed to going through training? How did that differ from the training?
To be frank, it didn't seem to be a change. It was just more of the same, because we'd all gone through this in terms of knowing what we had to do, and we knew what we were up against, and we knew that people coming back had all sorts of diseases and being unwell. There was all sorts of issues in terms of families and those sorts of things, so we had to cope with all that as well, trying to help the families understand, and particularly often dealing with the son's sexuality, which they probably didn't know about. So those issues, the homophobia, then you had the community as a whole who were concerned about them living next door, whatever it was, going to work, whatever it might have been. Obviously some of those people weren't able to go to work anyway. And then you're dealing with social services, and you're dealing with medical fraternity who didn't know what to do with them, who were just as scared as anybody else, and if they went to hospital, they were faced with their food slid under the door of the room because they were isolated from everybody else. And, people didn't know how to cope with it. They didn't know how to handle these people. And that was a major problem for society as a whole. It was the whole unfairness of it. Because people were gay, these men were gay, why had sex with men, people ostracized them. So it was a sexuality as well as a disease. And it was almost like an excuse that, oh great, we've got something now which will get rid of these people. And we won't make their life any easier. And not willing to understand that transmission was more of a closer relationship than just being in the same room or drinking from the same coffee cup and all that sort of stuff. And I said in my paper, I mean, we as carers and involved in education of a wide set of community, particularly health community, that people were very careful about not drinking the same or having the same mug or cup of coffee as we had. Those sorts of issues were very prevalent. And not touching. That's probably the hardest thing for people with HIV. But nobody in those days wanted to touch them. Our carers knew it was okay. So they were the ones who actually provided that. So it was ostracising a whole group of young people. I mean, these were young people. There were people in their late teens, early 20s, who had a whole life before them, before. And now, maybe 1 year, maybe less, maybe 6 months. They were difficult times. They were political times. And we had to confront those people who were making these irrational decisions. We had to confront the health services for how inappropriate it was that these people should be isolated in such a manner that people would gown up and put masks on and gloves and what have you before even going in the room. I mean, sure, there was some uncertainty about the virus, but it became pretty aware that this virus was transmitted in certain ways. It wasn't just through the air. Because if it was through the air, let's face it, there would have been 50,000 more times people coming down with it than what there was. And of course, the whole thing about the right wing and the evangelists and all the rest of them, the fundamentalists, grasped onto this one and said, here's the condemnation from God and so forth. So you would have all that to cope with as well. And they were really quite happy to, you know, to pour this onto these people and condemn them as being sinners and so forth. So you all had all that stuff. So it was a very complex issue, and still is today. But I mean, in those days it was very even more complex because of the fact was that we were still not totally aware of all the repercussions in those early days.
I also have to apologise for the sound effects in the background, which is, I think, some construction work, possibly because of the earthquakes earlier on, but it's unfortunate. So I do hope this our voices carry across over the school blade. So in 1986, the AIDS Foundation came into being. I'm just wondering, how did we move from the AIDS Support Network through to the AIDS Foundation? How did that happen?
Well, I mean, AIDS Support Network was basically a volunteer group. There was no funding. I mean, we supplied our own funding. And then the government gave some money in 86. And it was then feasible to employ somebody to be in a coordinating role nationally, as well as a board was established and those sorts of things. And it really was just a question of combining that structure with the existing structures and putting them together and calling them all the AIDS Foundation, which then really was helpful in terms of coordinating the focus, as well as having something to go to the government with and saying, well, we've got this under our hat here, this is happening now, we need funding for it. And that's how it happened. So the funding came in drips and drabs. I think it was 100,000 in the first instance, and then there was more money coming later on. But you see, the AIDS Foundation also presented a very political front, because it was actually able to communicate with the politicians directly, and there were people who were in the foundation at that point in time, sort of later on in 86, who had a lot of expertise in that political area and a lot of connections, important connections. So that was all part of that process, all part of that game, if you like. And also the funding that came through then provided also the ability to employ people in the national sense, as well as the local sense. So that's when there was an appointment made here of regional coordinator.
Was there ever a tension between, I guess, going from, you know, a completely voluntary situation to something that has paid staff, and also a tension between going from a kind of a support organisation to something that's a bit more political? Were there tensions there?
No. The reality was that the people who were driving the local AIDS Support Network were all people who had were employed, except for myself. They all were busy with their jobs and what have you. And this was becoming quite large in terms of time and commitment. Not that they begrudged that, but the fact was that, I mean, the reality is they've got to earn the bread and butter first before they can start giving. And there was no real problem at all. We wanted to retain our autonomy in terms of being a South Island organisation, no doubt about that. And we wanted to obviously have a say in what was happening in South Island, because Auckland-based organisations have a tendency to dismiss the South Island as being something down there, and we'll just let, you know, forget about that for a while. So we made our voice heard about those issues that might come up, but other than that, it was very supportive in terms of having a body there which was able to source funding, channel the funding, and provide that support as well. But we still had to fundraise as well, because there was never enough money anyway.
So did the AIDS Support Network, did that dissolve, or did it kind of morph into
it? It just morphed into it.
Yeah.
There was no actual process. It just happened. AIDS Foundation came along and interviews were done for people to be employed, and that's the way it went. And we all realised, obviously, that we weren't, as a loose volunteer organisation, we're not able to provide that sort of national focus. I mean, we're talking about a huge problem here. We're talking about a national problem. It's not just the Christchurch problem or Wellington or Auckland or wherever. It was a national problem which had to be coped with on a national basis and had to have that power behind it and had to have the right people behind it. You had to play that political game. I mean, you had the... you had the Governor General, who was Paul Reeves, became patron, all that sort of thing. It was all a political process, but it had to happen, because otherwise, how are you going to raise awareness? How are you going to get the politicians on the side? How are you going to get the money from the system?
Do you think in the formation of the AIDS Foundation that the focus changed? I'm thinking, you know, when we're talking about awareness, education, support, politics, how did you work out what were the main things that the AIDS Foundation should do?
Well, that was done. I mean, obviously, it was done with discussion with the various centres, and it was we had meetings in Auckland as well. And obviously, the priorities obviously were to provide support for people who aren't coming on well, provide political support for the law reform. Also, source funding, which is another important thing, more funding, and produce materials. Information was one of the first priorities, because you had to get information out there. And if you've, I don't know if you have seen the first information posters that came out, they were A2 or A1. They were pretty big. Probably about the size of that mirror. Is it an A2? Maybe anyone. Anyway, doesn't matter. Those posters were literally full of information. They were, in terms of impact, they were not made for impact. They were there to provide information. And those posters were very expensive. They were glossy paper. They were circulated right through the country, and were up everywhere with AIDS and big red letters and so forth. And it was also making people aware that we're talking about HIV here. That's transmitted, and not AIDS. AIDS is the end of the line. People thought, well, here's somebody who looks ill, they must have HIV. Well, AIDS, well, possibly that might be right. Here's somebody who looks fine, they probably haven't got anything. So they had to get the message that HIV was a hidden category in this, hidden infection, and that AIDS was the end result of that, of other infections, because of our immune system. And so those sorts of messages had to be got through. And also, don't be afraid. It's okay to drink from a cup that somebody else might have used a week ago. Or it's okay to do this, okay to do that, and blah, blah, blah. So that sort of information giving was really important as an initial step, because we had to pave the way to try and offset this discrimination, this fear that was happening in communities. And it wasn't just out there, was also within gay men, who have sex with men, community. But yeah, I mean, we also had to inform how not to get this disease, and the link up then, of course, with sexual activity and transmission of body fluids and so forth. So that was another national effort. Locally, we couldn't do that because we didn't have the money to do it with, but nationally, they had the money from the government to do it with. And their direct communication is, and inform the government, this is what we're doing, this is the health process, and so on. So that was their advantages, there were no two ways about that.
Did you see a change in gay or men who have sex with men's attitudes towards sex?
Yes and no. We weren't the sex police or anything like that, and we weren't there to stop people from having a good time. But we did a lot of work in venues in terms of education, and we also did a lot of fundraising with gay communities and gay lesbian communities. You know, lesbian community women came on board as well, and they were great and supportive, even though they weren't effective to any great degree, although later on there had been a few cases. But, yeah, I mean, there are obviously some people who made decisions not to do certain things, not to do penetrative sex without a condom and all this sort of stuff. Others decide not to have sex at all. Almost became celibate. I mean, that was their overreaction. But if you had the information, if you understood how this virus is transmitted, and we're talking about later on here, how this virus is transmitted, then obviously they would be comfortable about what they could and what they couldn't do. So, I mean, that was part of the education program, and that came, more of that came later, because the foundation funded the people working in prevention within gay community, or men who have sex with men, I should say. Because, I mean, a lot of people don't identify as gay. Men or sex with men is the point. We're talking about activities. We're talking about not necessarily where your head's at, but what you do with your dick. Simple as that.
Do you think that the level of denial decreased? I mean, were people still denying it in the, you know, 85, 86 period, saying, no. Oh, I won't happen here? Or?
I don't think so. Took a long time after that. Still, it doesn't happen today, does it? A lot of people still in denial.
That think it won't happen here.
Yeah. And there are always people who don't care. There are always people who don't take responsibility for themselves or other people. Simple as that. I mean, let's face it, it takes two to tango. You can't blame one person with HIV and the one that hasn't. If they both make a decision about having a risk activity. We're talking about risk activities here. We're not talking about risk. We're not talking about risk people. We're talking about risk activities. And that's a message that took a long time to get through. And we're talking about HIV, which is a hidden disease, as opposed to AIDS. So that denial's still there, and there are still people. I mean, there are people in those days, sure, were in denial, and there are still people today in denial. Unfortunately, or ignorance, but I can't understand how they can be ignorant about HIV today. Maybe they are. I don't know.
So 1986, the AIDS Foundation is in place, and you become the regional coordinator in the Canterbury region, is it?
South Island.
South Island.
Mm.
What did that involve?
Basically more of the same. It's continuing on with the program, continue on with recruitment, continue on with diversification. Where are we going to utilise our volunteers and so forth, and what sort of programs could we? I mean, the National had their prime focus was men who have sex with men. My argument here was, well, that's fine, because that's where the virus is today, and where the highest percentage of the virus is there then, as it is today. But if we don't do something about other at-risk activity, then there's no reason why this virus shouldn't spread to other areas and other people. Heterosexual, didn't matter what it was, bisexual, whoever. If you looked at Africa and what potentially we saw was happening there, huge numbers of people were being infected. It wasn't men with sex with men, it was heterosexual. We're talking about a virus here. It doesn't give a bugger what you are. Who you are is what you do. So it's quite simple as that. So we can't sit on we couldn't sit on laurels and think, well, okay, well, this is a men's disease. Women won't get it because there's proof out there that it is. The foundation's philosophy was that the virus was mainly when men have sex with men, and that's where we should be putting our energies. we down here diversified a bit because of what South Island does quite often. Up Auckland, but not in a nasty way, but we're separated by a piece of water. So we started doing education in schools. We started doing education with nurses, with GPs. We started to recruit more Māori going through the training program. And at this stage, I think we always had people coming and going, but we had a consistent 120 people, 120 volunteers. Now, we weren't going to get hundreds of people with AIDS. So it made sense to actually utilise these people with various skills to work in other areas. And we hired, through the generosity of a well-known person in Christchurch, we were given a room in one of the bigger buildings near the square, which housed our volunteer group. And I mean, we had, let's say, about 120 volunteers, and we had regular weekly Sunday meetings. Not quite church, nothing like that. But it was a training session often. We had updates given updates on what was happening in terms of that, and also to talk about their individual groups that they eventually were slotted into as they volunteered to do. So we looked at the sex industry, male and female. We looked at the IV drug users because they were injecting and sharing equipment. As I said, the Māori population was vulnerable because they were basically discriminated against in many, many areas. And we looked at other areas as well. But primarily we focused on Māori drug use, IV drugs, and sex industry, as well as, of course, many of the men. And so we recruited actively people from those groups, and we trained them as well, for them, not for us, not as white gay males to do, but for them to set up their own organisations to go out and get this all happening out there. And as a result of that, we had one woman who became coordinator of the Prostitutes Collective, still is today. We had a IV drug user who happened to be also a gay man, who had extensive experience in Europe and Asia in terms of the drug fraternity and what you could do and what you couldn't do. He was also a part Aborigine from Australia and had been on his own since he was 18 or something, and travelled around the world. There was a guy who knew what it was all about. He had connections. So he then got involved in the whole IVD, or IV drug use community. Well, he wasn't really, but in terms of the education and so forth. Him and Gary McGrath both of you are dead now, from Wellington, travelled up and down the country and lobbied organisations involved in drug rehabilitation as well as government to bring in a needle exchange program. I worked with Roger, he was Roger Wright, who's a centre is called after him here, and he bashed my ear about drug use for a long time. I mean, I knew practically nothing about it. I'd heard of pills and stuff, but didn't know much about injecting. So anyway, Roger and Gary finally got this through the bill, and it was changed, the law was changed about possession of needle syringes. That's history now. And of course, these exchanges were set up. Māori Te Rupu Tautoko was the arm of the Māori arm for AIDS Prostitutes Collective in terms of education for working women, working men. And as I say, we also got involved we provide sessions for GPs because their skills in terms of counselling were pretty abysmal. And we got one of the top counsellors down from North Island, who I think is still alive, I can't remember his name right now, who did Saturday and Sunday morning sessions. The only way we were getting there was by promising them a free lunch. And so we persuaded them in that way. And we did sessions with polytechnics who were training students in terms of nursing. We went to the mental health people, and we also went to prisons. We did work out of the local prison here, particularly with men. And that didn't go down too well with the officers, but anyway. And we advocated that there should be condoms available in prison and there should be free needles and syringes. Well, you know, we're talking about the 80s here. And still it hasn't happened today. So we diversified, and we, say, talked to school kids, 13 upwards, and got permission from parents and what have you. We did it right. But we didn't hide anything. We talked about sexuality, we talked about sex. We weren't doing the job in any other organisation. We were doing something unique in terms of that. And we even went to Catholic schools and talked about user condoms and stuff like that. So, I mean, it was quite revealing just how accepting the institutions were about these things, because they realised the possibility of young people becoming infected. And they also realised that they had to do something. And there was no point in hiding the fact that we were talking about sex. We were talking about penetrative sex. We're not talking about sex in any other form, but penetrative sex. And that this is what you need to do if you're going to have penetrative sex. We were obviously saying, well, it's not a good idea at your age, but if it's going to happen in the future, this is what you need to do. Same time, we knew kids of 10 and 12 were having penetrative sex. And that's probably hasn't changed much today. So to say that kids shouldn't have sex education until after they're 14 or 15 or 16 is a load of rubbish, because the fact is that they could become infected. And as time goes on, if people don't become aware, it will happen.
Was there any negative reaction or resistance to those kind of programs being out there?
No, it wasn't. Actually, it's really low-key. We didn't make a big noise about it. We just contacted the school and contacted the right people, and people who were responsible for the health curriculum, whatever it was, cleared it with the parents. They had the option of saying the child could go or not go, and 96% said yes. So it was really low-key. I mean, the public didn't probably really know what was going on. I mean, if we'd made a noise about it, maybe. Family planning, I was trying to say. We weren't crossing over family planning's area, but we were doing something from the point of view of frontline HIV education.
Now, around the same time, there were things like the candlelight memorials and the AIDS quilt. AIDS memorial quilt was coming up in, I think it was 1988. Did you have much to do with those type of things?
That came from America, that concept. The quilt was very, very good at raising awareness about what was happening and the loss of life. It might have been in Auckland first when it really started up there. I can't just put a date on it now. I wasn't personally involved in that. But when it did come down here, I'd gone to Thailand at that point. And they had it in the cathedral here for several years at different times.
A number of people I've spoken to just recount the late 80s as a time, well, late 80s and early 90s, when they were going to multiple funerals. Like, one person was telling me, you know, every fortnight there was a funeral. Did that happen in Christchurch?
Yeah, on a not as great extent. I mean, obviously people were dying. I knew a lot of people who died. But, I mean, it wasn't like Auckland. I mean, Auckland had a huge number of people who died. And, I mean, let's face it, you still had, to some extent, your ghettoised community, even though law reform had gone through, but this transition was happening over a period of time, but out to the wide four winds, if you like. But, yeah, I mean, people had grown up together. People had partied together. They'd probably sex together and knew each other well. They had groups met for meals and shows and whatever, and that sort of thing. All those relationships were established over a long period of time. So you obviously had, the bigger your sphere of friends, I mean, the more people you were subject to being lost. So, I mean, it did happen here. I mean, it happened even with some of our volunteers. But, it wasn't to the same extent. And unfortunately, often hidden, because people were never actually... It was never actually said they had HIV. They died of something. I mean, obviously they didn't die of HIV itself. They died of pneumonia or they died of something. And that's normally what was on the death certificate, was that they died of pneumonia. So people didn't always know they died of HIV. And that, in a way, did a disservice. I mean, okay, it was protecting the family, protecting the partner, maybe. But on the other hand, people weren't aware of the numbers of people that really were dying. Became notified, but that's only statistics. I mean, it's just a number on a piece of paper. But if you know this person, this person, this person, this person, that really hits home. And it kind of makes you sit up and think, oh, yeah. It's not just in the next city, it's here, you know, the next country.
When did you leave the AIDS Foundation?
Initially, 1990, the first time.
And why was that?
I suppose I was an activist, an entrepreneur. And organisations have a phase. They have an establishment phase where you recruit, where you raise awareness, where you do political stuff and all that. Do all those fundamental things to put an organisation on its feet and place. I was the entrepreneur. I was used to being able to promote. I was used to being able to sell something. And that's what it was really about for me. And I was an administrator as well as. I still did a lot of hands-on stuff. But the AIDS Foundation was becoming more bureaucratic. There were more. It was more sort of power-based in Auckland. There were national managers being appointed and that sort of stuff. And I thought, well, I've done my bit. I'll see what I can do overseas. And the reason why I went to Thailand, I went to Thailand in 1990 to the first AIDS conference in Bangkok. That was the first Asian. I went there simply because I knew that there was a major tourist activity from here to Thailand. And most of those were heterosexual. Well, a lot weren't. But it was only a matter of time, because in Thailand there was a huge problem. 60% of all the farmers in northern Thailand were infected because of sex workers. I knew it was only a matter of time. These people going backwards and forwards are going to increase the probability here. And I thought, well, if I can contribute something to Thailand in terms of the people there, which are going to help New Zealand eventually, then I would go and do something there. That's the reason why I went. So I got out of the organisation here simply because of becoming more bureaucratic. It wasn't really... I didn't feel totally comfortable. I hadn't lost sight of what it was about, but I didn't feel totally comfortable with that role in that organisation. And a regional coordinator was flexible. Managers aren't. It's a different role.
But you actually did come back to the AIDS Foundation in the early 2000s. How did that happen?
Well, I hadn't... When I came back from Thailand, I mean, I worked over there, voluntary. I came back and didn't have a job or anything and tried to get back to Asia, in fact, with the World Health Organization. And they offered me a job in New Guinea, working there, and I thought, my God, I know nothing about New Guinea. There's about 700 languages. How am I going to possibly fit in there, and how am I going to get my messages through to what was happening there? And I declined it. So I didn't get any office, any other office. So anyway, then a doctor friend of mine who had been a volunteer in the AIDS Foundation, straight as I might add, but that was the interesting thing about the AIDS Foundation as it went on. More and more heterosexual women came forward, as well as some heterosexual men. Just another side. He was chair of a trust which ran a needle exchange program. And he said to me, at the time I didn't have a job or anything, he said to me, look, we're looking for a manager. And would you be interested? And I thought, well, I don't have a job at the moment. I knew a bit about IV drug use because of Roger had taught me. And I knew I'd been chair of the first board in 87. So I knew how it ran. And so I said, okay, I'll give it a go for a couple of years. And I stayed on until 89, I think it was. What am I saying? 1998. Let's get it right. Getting my years mixed up here. And then I decided that I got bored with that because I'd put things in place, was running pretty well. We were getting more and more clients. I mean, the whole thing was growing quite well. And I'd been involved in the national organisation as well, the Needle Exchange Program. So I resigned, and then another opportunity came along, which meant that I had to take care of some at-risk people in Christchurch, and became team leader for an organisation which cared for these people. And these people were HIV positive. Did that for 2 years. And then they changed the program. So I was out of work again. And then the position of manager for the AIDS Foundation came up. And I applied for that.
So in the 2000s now, how had the HIV AIDS landscape changed, in your opinion?
It actually changed. It had changed, speaking from here, it had changed quite radically. Not the situation itself, but the way that it was being handled. You see, when you look at it in 90, we had 120 volunteers doing various activities. When I went away, it was all closed down, except for the clinic. Itty Route Clinic was called then, which provide counselling and support services. So there was a group of support people and a person employed in managing prevention education. And that was it. The whole organisation had been contracted down. Further national managers had been appointed. All the funding went through Auckland. And the autonomy had gone. So when I came back in 2000, it was a different organisation. It was very much, it was focused on support. You still had your one prevention education officer who had to do the whole area, South Island. And the emphasis really was on support. And sure, there were obviously more people who required support. But I did find it difficult. I suppose it was because of my background.
And when you say support, what would that mean practically for somebody?
Well, counselling, people with HIV counselling. Support in terms of medical health area, in terms of accommodation, all those sorts of things necessary for a person with terminal disease, or potentially a terminal, I should say. Because, I mean, by then, of course, the treatments have come along, which made a huge difference, and people were living a lot longer. But also presented more problems for those people living longer because of the fact they were trying to cope with medications and bouts of disease and stuff like that, and also discrimination still, which hasn't changed a hell of a lot. So, I mean, it's, yeah, that was great. I mean, there was good things happening there. But I still was concerned about the lack of that community involvement in terms of education and prevention and stuff, and that support process. I mean, one person trying to do all that, that was a horrendous job. And it couldn't be done properly. It's still the same today. Anyway, that's the way it was. And I did some radical things, I suppose, which didn't go down very well for some people. The initial clinic, when I was there, was set up. We'd had a hospital board. We set up our own clinic initially in conjunction with hospital board in those days. Didn't get on with them. Political, they wanted total control. They wanted everyone to go through the STD clinic and all the rest of it. Said, no, bugger off, we're not going to do that. We pulled out. And we moved premises to a couple of apartments, ground floor apartments. Single, they were two-story apartments joined together, and they were in Montreal Street and up near Cashel and Billy Avenue, and we set up our clinic there, and it was called the Issy Route Clinic, because Issy Route basically was a person in the First World War who handled condoms and things out to the troops and all the rest of it. So that was it. There was the clinic. We did get some premises next door, a house for a massage and treatment room, and that was it. All the rest had gone. So that was what I left. When I left 90, the whole thing had been contracted down to that clinic, and that was it. So the organisation had radically changed from the days that I've been involved. But what had happened in the meantime was they had gone and left that premise in Montreal Street and moved to premises in the hospital. Well, that's okay. When I got there, the first thing I found was that the offices and rooms were very small. They shared one large room with the administration for the STI clinic downstairs. They were on the second floor, or first floor, maybe on the ground floor, first floor, which meant anybody with any illness would have to go to climb those downstairs. The prevention room... the room that the prevention person had would not have been much bigger than your probably the kitchen there. So small. Incredible. The other rooms weren't much better. So I decided that we get out of there. I mean, it had been quite a long association. I'd been there for several years. And the previous two managers had been quite happy there. But I thought, no, this is no good. I thought, we've got to go back to the community. We're not part of the hospital system. Sure, people, they go to hospital, they see the specialists there, so forth, but that doesn't happen every day. So I hunted around for rooms, and I hunted around for a building, particularly a building with some character and some warmth about it, because the hospital building is just concrete. And so hunted around, and... found, eventually, after being given the runaround by a few people, once they knew who we were, didn't want us anyway, it was a question of finding the right building with the right owner. Found the right building eventually, after five or six goes, and the right owner. The owner, as it happened, had a friend who in the UK who died of AIDS. He was very happy with being in his building. Quite a large old villa, and it was very suitable because it had lots of rooms and stuff like that, and a garden. So I shifted the AIDS Foundation from where we were in hospital to there, which actually turned out to be in Hereford Street. And next door was the City Mission, which I didn't think was any big deal. People in the City Mission go out at 8 o'clock in the morning and come back in about 5 or 6. Our hours were from 9 until 5. So any clients coming in wouldn't need to have anything to do with City Mission. But as it turned out, people weren't happy. But the people who weren't, were not happy were the people who never came to us anyway. But the clients, finally, they seemed to adopt it and find it was fine. I mean, the building was great. Unfortunately, it's fallen over with the last earthquakes. But, yeah, now they're Cashel Street somewhere. Yeah. So, anyway. I suppose my relationship with the foundation had been quite good initially, and then after a while I began to challenge things, and I came to a crunch anyway, and I said, okay, my position here is not tenable, I'll resign. So that's what I did. So that was the end of my involvement with AIDS Foundation for the second time. But I think, yeah, I was able to contribute something anyway.
I'm just wondering, finally, if you could tell me what impact HIV/AIDS and the work that you've been doing has had on your life. How has it changed you? How has it affected you?
I'm obviously a lot more aware about social issues. I'm still involved in the IV drug use as chair of the board and also on the national board. So I still got some, retained some, interest in that area, not just because it's drug use, but because of HIV. It's provided, well, personally, I mean, it's provided me a lot of skills, met a lot of great people. A big education, plus for me as well. I mean, yeah, there's all that. Awareness of those social issues. I mean, it's been very rewarding. And also meeting, as I say, a lot of great people in terms of all walks of life, you know. Yeah. And a chance to contribute something, because we all kind of go through life, particularly if you're self-employed, something like that, and you're sort of focused on what you're doing, probably with not a great regard for what the rest of the world's doing around you. I'm not saying that's a generalisation, I'm just saying that can happen. And that became rewarding in terms of being able to contribute. Yeah.